are similarities between Fermi liquid theory and high energy scattering, which are on the face of it quite dissimilar for many reasons. So most of it I'll talk, so I'm going to sort of assume that Fermi liquid theory is probably much more appreciated in this audience than high energy scattering, and in particular, the effective field theories discussed for high energy scattering. So I'll probably spend a little bit more time discussing the effective field theory of high energy scattering just to set up the analogies with Fermi liquid theory. And then towards the end, I'll talk about how recent advances in our understanding of high energy scattering related to LHC observables could shed light on von Hoeff singularities and their effective field theories. So that part of the talk is in ongoing work with Anton Kapustin. And the first part of the talk will involve work done in collaboration with Duff Neal, Ambar Jain, and Mani Chu. Okay, so so how are Fermi liquid theory? So let me just give a sort of general overall picture about why Fermi liquid theory and high energy scatterings have anything to do with each other. So in both cases, they are field theories which are non-canonical, non-generic effective field theories in the sense that they're both based on field theories in which we expand around particular kinematic configurations as opposed to, say, some generic field theory like chiral perturbation theory or in a, you know, even heavy quark effective theory. So if we look at the kinematics of the situation, so the effective field theory of high energy scattering is called SCET, so I'll use this term SCET, and this effective field theory was developed by Bauer, Pershall, Stewart, and Fleming, and Luke. So the similarities are in that if we look at high energy scattering, and I look at a parton, sorry, with some large light-like momentum, then what I'm interested in doing is I'm interested in looking at small fluctuations around that rapidly moving particle, right? So I'm interested in have one other direction, and I'm interested basically in small fluctuations around the light cone. Okay, so in two different light cone directions, and as far as the dynamics of this rapidly moving parton, it experiences some small fluctuations that leave the invariant mass unchanged, essentially. So we'll take the invariant mass of these partons. So we're going to take k squared is of order lambda qcd squared, which is some small scale compared to the scale of height of the scattering, which is q squared. So okay. So we're interested in small fluctuations around this semi-classical iconal line, basically. And we have two types of fluctuations that can leave that line on shell. In other words, we want to look at a particle moving very fast and ask what kind of fluctuations lead to small changes in the virtuality. And there are two such fluctuations. One is where the particle splits to another collinear line, or when if has some small energy. So there's two sort of directions of fluctuations we're interested in. One in is away from the light cone by looking at small collinear fluctuations or parton splitting. And the other one is some soft radiation which can leave the particle on shell around the origin in momentum space. So in Fermi liquid theory, here's some Fermi surface, and we're interested in small fluctuations around the Fermi surface. So this is K Fermi. But in both situations, we're interested in there's some large momentum, right? And we're interested in small fluctuations around that momentum, right? So these are what's known as what I like to call modal theories, because there are different types of modes which contribute to the interesting dynamics, right? So in this case, it's some small energy fluctuation. In this case, it could be either collinear fluctuations or soft fluctuations. Okay, and we'll see in the case of a von Hoff singularity that there are additional modes that will make it look, so here it looks like there's only one type of mode, which is a small, what I would call a soft mode. And then here I'd have soft and collinear modes. But what I'll hope to show you is that when you have a von Hoff singularity, then you have additional modes. Okay, and that, as I said, so I'll discuss that probably towards the end of the talk. Yes?
Also the fluctuation when you take one particle from this part and move it far away.
Yeah.
Along the curve.
Mm-hmm. So this is fluctuations in energy, not in momentum.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So fluctuation in momentum is large.
Yes, that's right.
So this is like an additional degree of freedom.
That's correct. So yeah. So you can have large momenta and large, so certainly you can scatter as long as you stay within the shell a small energy. And so that's important. And it's similarly true in the case of high energy scattering, because I have some momentum with some particle with large Lyko momentum P plus, and it can split to another one. And now this can change by order one.
Yeah.
So in that sense, that's very similar to the case of the Fermi liquids. That's right. Okay. So in both cases, I have some power counting parameter, which I'll define as lambda. So in this case, the power counting parameter will be some infrared scale, typically, say, could be the lambda QCD, strong coupling scale, or it could be some other scale, some other infrared scale, depending on the observable that you're interested in. And in this case, we have the small energy fluctuations around the Fermi surface, and I'll call this lambda as well. Okay, so those are the power counting parameters. And what I want to do is I want to write down an effective field theory in which every term in the action scales homogeneously in the power counting parameter, so I can do things in a systematic fashion. So that will entail determining what the dynamical degrees of freedom are at low scales. And of course, this is well known in the case of Fermi liquid theory, and I'll explain more about what's going on here. Now, of course, as far as similarities, further similarities is the fact that in both cases, and this I think is the most salient point, the relevance of operators depends upon special kinematics. Okay, so we'll see as we discuss the relevance of operators in the action that there'll be very similarities in the fact that we have to look at specific operators. The relevance of an operator depends upon the specific momentum configuration you're looking at. Of course, in Fermi liquid theory, you're all familiar with the fact that the BCS channel is relevant, while its other channels are not. And for those, and I'll talk about a little bit about that for those in the audience who have not thought about this much. So of course, the dissimilarities are perhaps as eye-popping as the similarities. This one go up. This one does not go up. Okay. So of course, the dissimilarities are of course of the symmetries. Okay, so in SCT or in QCD at high energies, we have lots of symmetry. So we have, of course, we have relativistic symmetry. We have Classically, we have conformal symmetry, and at if we look at the effective theory, small fluctuations around have actually three gauge symmetries corresponding to a collinear bar and a soft gauge symmetry, and I'll explain how these symmetries emerge in the effective theory that are not present in the full theory. Okay, and if in Fermi liquid theory, the one time reversal invariance plays a crucial role in understanding the kinematics. Rotational invariance we'll take when we want to make our calculation simpler, but are not necessary. And of course, everything else is broken by the yes. So conformal invariance will be broken quantum mechanically. The relativistic invariance is so we'll choose directions. So, but in the end, of course, we'll write everything down in terms of some light-like four vectors to regenerate the full relativistic invariance. So actually we'll be looking at scattering. So we'll actually be looking at two different directions, say back to back. And then the final result we'll be able to write down in terms of the directions of the, but I can always write it down in terms in a completely invariant way.
So here you always keep a fixed background.
Right. That's right. Okay.
Is time reversal going to be for the DCS?
Yeah, in general, you could relax time reversal, but it makes, so the relevance of operators depends upon the fact that there's always this point at the other end, which makes the kinematics interesting. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about about the effective field theory of high energy scattering. So the acronym SCT stands for soft collinear effective theory, and exactly because of the diagram that I drew previously. Because the relevant fluctuations are soft and collinear, and hence the name. So the idea, and this will be true in the case of Fermi liquid theory also, is to use the fact that the large light cone momentum of the particle plays no role in the dynamics, right? The small fluctuations leave that momentum invariant. So we want to remove that scale from the theory, much in the same way we want to remove the Fermi energy from the theory. The Fermi energy is a UV scale. It's irrelevant, right? And yet we still need large momenta to change because we allow scattering with large KF, right? So we want to remove them from the dynamics and the power counting, but we need to include them in the theory because they're crucial for scattering, right? So the way we go about this is by what's sometimes called the label formalism. So let me first consider an energetic particle. So let me consider P mu, and I'm going to decompose it into light cone momenta. So N and M bar are light cone unit vectors, light-like unit vectors. Okay, and I'm going to take my momentum. I'm going to choose it such that this is p plus, p minus, and I'm going to choose the scaling. So this is order 1 in units of q. This is order lambda squared, and this is order lambda. Okay. So that p squared is order lambda squared, which is order lambda qcd squared in units. Of Q, okay? Okay, so the way we want to set up this theory is we want to remove the large scales. The large scales should not be part of the low energy theory. So the way we do this is we take our fields, and we do a partial Fourier transform in this way. So the idea is that now all derivatives acting on the fields scale as lambda or lambda squared, depending on which one. So for instance, a perp acting on this field will scale as lambda, and n bar dot p acting on this field will scale as lambda squared. Okay, so this essentially, by rescaling the fields, we've removed these non-dynamical, these high energy degrees of freedom, but we've left them in the theory because we need to allow for scattering, right? So the way I like to think about it is we tessellate momentum space into bins. So this is order Q lambda. This is order Q lambda squared. And so this is in the perp direction. And this is in the plus direction. Okay. So I take this is the large momentum. And I've broken it up into a large momentum and two and some box composed of small residual momentum. So the size of the box is sort of lambda squared. And this is called the residual momentum. OK? So these fields carry this residual momentum, but the large momentum's been removed. OK?
Yeah. Direction,
So remember that lambda is still much. So the smallest scale in the theory is lambda squared, mm-hmm. and p perp is sort of lambda. So we want to remove that one, and since now all derivatives. This one.
Yeah.
So this is order lambda, which is still much smaller than lambda squared. Oh. I'm sorry. This is lambda squared. I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay, so and notice that so we do this in a discrete way, which of course would be calculationally obtrusive. So actually, what we were going to do in the end is, whenever I have so we break up the momenta into the large momenta, which I write with a hat, and a residual momenta, and if I have a sum over labels and an integral over dk, then I will just combine the large momenta and the residual momenta into just a dp. Okay, but there'll be times when this label momenta won't be there, and that will be crucial. This sum won't be there because when the sum is not there, this will scale as lambda. When the sum is there, it scales as 1. And this, in fact, is how we'll see that, for instance, the one loop correction in the forward scattering channel in Fermi-liquid theory actually vanishes. So usually, like if you look at the papers by Shankar and Polchinski, they talk about how the loop corrections in the BCS channel, in the forward scattering channel, are down by 1 over n. But in the spirit of effective field theory, we want everything to scale homogeneously. So your leading order action should only lead to leading order observables, and all power corrections should be 0. So the way I'm going to formulate it is that those corrections will actually vanish. They won't be down by 1 over n. They should vanish, as they should if you have a well-defined effective theory. Okay, so let us now write down an action for this collinear field. So first I'm going to define p hat as a label operator. So p hat will pick out the large momentum. Okay, so this is how we get a homogeneously scaling a theory where we find things scale homogeneously is we separate the large and the small momenta. So p hat is acts only on the labels. So p hat on theta of p will give p theta of x. Okay. So if we write down now x, let me write down an action. So we have d4x sum over labels p psi bar n of p, p bar plus I d slash psi n of p. Okay? So now I've explicitly pulled out the large and the small momentum, and this is what, as I said multiple times now, this is what's going to allow me to, find a homogeneous scaling. Okay? Now, since this is only acting on the large momenta, this p bar slash will be in what I've chosen, my directions. Okay? So it picks out the two large pieces of the momenta, and this guy scales as lambda squared. Now, this doesn't scale homogeneously, and we said that our goal will be to write down an action which scales homogeneously. And the reason is because this four spinner has a large and a small component at large momentum, right? So chirality conservation tells you that if you're moving in one direction, the chirality doesn't flip. So we're going to decompose it into a large and a small component. So let me define two spinner projection operators, Pm bar, which is a 1/4 m bar slash n slash, and Pn, 1/4 n slash m bar slash. And then I'll write psi as a linear combination of Cn plus rho n, where these guys are the projectors of Cn is Pn psi, and rho n is Pm bar psi. Okay? And now I'm going to plug this back into the action. And I find that rho n, which is a small component, is up to power corrections and auxiliary field and can be integrated out. So rho n, which is a small component of the spinner, is integrated out. And the resulting action looks like some more labels, Cn bar. Okay, so it's a non-local theory. Now, this action is nothing but QCD quantized on the light cone, because I haven't done anything. All I have is one particle moving very fast, and I've basically quantized it in that boosted frame. So it's a non-local action as a consequence of the fact that I integrated out the small component. However, now what we have accomplished by this seemingly trivial exercise is that we have universal scaling. Every term in the action scales the same way. So this guy is a small residual momentum. It's a derivative. Each one of these labels scales as lambda. This scales as lambda. This scales as 1. And now the action scales homogeneously. So we've done this work strictly for the purpose of getting an action where everything scales homogeneously. Okay. Now, now we need to figure out how the field scales, because the scaling of the field will tell us what operators, what interactions are relevant, just as it does in BCS theory. Okay. So let me power count this thing by going to let's power count in momentum space. So I have. Pardon me. So it's non-local in the sense that it scales of order the large scale. It's non-local, but at long distance scales, it looks completely local. Yeah, at low energy theory, it looks local. Yeah, but that's a consequence of the fact that it should not be thought of as a derivative operator anymore. It should be thought of as a number, right? Yeah. Okay, so let me power count this thing in momentum space. So let's look at the fields in momentum space. Now these are no longer, so these guys are operators. Okay. Now, so this, as we said, this thing scales as lambda squared. And now the question is, how does a measure scale? So this is the same exercise we're going to go through when we look at Fermi liquid theory. Well, we're going to combine the large momentum labels with the D4, with the large pieces of these guys. So there'll be, so if I look at, there'll be a DNP, DP perp 2, and a DN bar dot K. So this guy scales as 1. This guy scales as lambda squared. This guy scales as lambda squared. So the measure scales as lambda to the 4th. Okay? So this thing has to scale as 1 because it's a leading order action. Though we conclude that in momentum space, the fields scale as lambda to the minus 3. Okay? Okay. Now let's use this scaling to determine what kind of interactions are allowed in the effective theory. As I said, this is the exact same thing we'll go through when we talk about Fermi liquid theory. Well, first of all, let me tell you, I'm not going to go through the scalings, but a collinear gluon has the following scalings. So this scales as lambda to the minus 3. This guy scales as lambda to the minus 2. And this guy scales as lambda to the minus 4. And the way you reach that is by doing the exactly analogous thing that I just did, but for the gluon action. It's this exact same exercise. So let's consider what kind of possible interactions we can have. Well, we know in the low energy theory, and I use the term low energy theory in a colloquial sense, we can have a splitting. A collinear splitting will leave every gluon on shell. So those are small fluctuations. These interactions should be allowed in the effective theory. OK, so the question is this relevant? Is this a relevant operator? And if it is a relevant operator, which polarization can interact with it? OK, so let's write down the action for it. So we have a sum over the momenta. So let's call this 1, 2, and 3. Then we have C bar n, C. Then we have an in some direction that we're going to figure out which one of these guys can possibly interact and leave this operator relevant. So as before, the measure scales as lambda to the 4th. Each one of these guys scales as lambda to the minus 3. And we have a delta function for momentum conservation. And the question is, how does a delta function scale? So this guy gives me lambda to the minus 2. And for the delta function, for the large momentum, I can combine. So there's also an implicit. So there's a P1, P2, P3 here. And there's an implicit conservation of the large momentum as well, which I can absorb into the delta function. So this will look something like sum over n dot p in one direction, sum over n dot k, and a delta function in p perps. OK, so this scales as lambda to the minus 2. This scales as lambda to the minus 2. So the net scaling goes like lambda to the minus 4. So there are 3 particles here. Oh, sorry. Let's see. So this should be, sorry, I have it wrong. Thank you. So it is, so for each one, it's 4. And then there's 3 particles. Thank you. So this is lambda to the 12 to the 6. Yeah. Lambda 2. Nope, I think I messed something up. 12 minus 6. So 12 minus 6 is 6, minus 2 minus 2. That's right. It's minus 8. Hold on. 10. Yeah. So this is telling us, so the net scaling goes like lambda to the minus 2. And so to scale as order 1, it's got a scale, it's got a couple to the n.a gluon. So you could ask the question, well, that seems to imply that it would be relevant operators if they coupled to the n bar dot a or the a perp. And that would seem to be problematic because you can't have terms in the action scaling as inverse powers of the power counting parameter. But the answer is that that is true, but we'll see that gauge invariance will prohibit those couplings. And what's interesting is I can also look at other couplings which don't exist in QCD. For instance, that coupling. And the power counting leads to the conclusion that these guys have to be A perps. Now, this is exactly what's telling us that when we covariantize this action, then we find that the action looks like okay. So now we can see that the interactions which we guess an n dot a and a 2a perps will come naturally, so that the power counting is consistent with the gauge invariance of the theory. Okay, so this is the action for collinear field. So this is full boosted QCD, and it's invariant under collinear gauge transformations. Where the gauge parameter has support that looks like in Lycone coordinates 1 lambda squared lambda. Okay? And the full QCD action then will be a sum of Sn and Sn bar. Okay? And this this statement is crucial. That notice that, and I can prove to you that there does not exist that the n n bar interactions are irrelevant. Okay. So, and that's a consequence strictly of the dynamic. So, if I look at an interaction, now I try to allow for an interaction like this. And I write down this action. So this thing will look like sum over labels in both the P and the P bar direction. Okay, so we can power count this, and we could see, so each one of these guys goes like, so this is each one of these guys scales as lambda to the minus 3, so we have lambda to the minus 12. But now the point is the delta function will no longer scale in the same way as it did in the other case of collinear dynamics, because there will always be at least one large momentum in two of the delta functions. So this delta function is now only going to scale like 1 over lambda squared. Okay. So because we have this special kinematics, so this is analogous to what happens away from forward scattering or the BCS channel, is that the delta function no longer scales as 1 over lambda to the fourth. It scales as 1 over lambda squared. So these interactions are not allowed. And then we have that S is Sm bar plus order lambda. Now, this is crucial because it means that the stress energy tensors completely decouple. And this, in fact, is the reason why we can do physics at the LHC. Okay? Because factorization is crucial. So this is factorization. And if I take any matrix element in QCD between, say, collinear operators in different directions, then I can write it in this way. And the Hilbert spaces completely decouple from each other. And that's why you're allowed to convolve a proton with a hard scattering amplitude. You have a short distance and a long distance piece. And that's a consequence of factorization. And that's why we can make predictions at the LHC, despite the fact that we have non-perturbative physics. OK, so I should say one other thing about kinematics. So there's another special kinematic region where you can get relevant operators, and that is forward scattering. So this is much the same as in Fermi liquid theory. So because I'm running out of time, forward scattering is also leading order. And this is really a problem in this theory that is usually glossed over. Because forward scattering, well, first of all, there's a huge amount of data at forward scattering. And when you have a relevant operator in the forward scattering channel, you lose predictive power. And that's why a huge chunk of the information at the LHC goes, I don't want to say to waste, but there are models for it. But there's no one knows how to systematically calculate in forward scattering. OK. So let me talk about calculating an observable in this theory, because it's going to shed light. It'll be relevant when we discuss von Hoff singularities if I don't run out of time. OK, so let's consider the Sudikoff form factor. So let me tell you what the Sudikoff form factor is. So the Sudikoff form factor is the matrix element of a current . So it's basically, you can consider electromagnetic current. And I've got some very energetic particle. In fact, I'm going to take them back to back to make my life easier. I'm going to go into a frame where they're back to back. And I have some Q squared coming in. And so this form factor shows up in many different observables. But the field theory of this form factor will lead to very interesting results, which will be relevant to von Hoff singularities. What time do I have till? Twelve thirty. Okay, I can finish by 12:30. That's not a problem. Okay, so. So let's look at the Sudikoff form factor. Now, So if I look at, so these guys are these semi-classical objects that are moving very quickly. And we have to ask, you know, there's hard stuff that's irrelevant. There are hard fluctuations we don't really care about. We care about the soft stuff fluctuations. The hard fluctuations can all be integrated out, and they just lead to some Wilson coefficient that sits in this operator that is fairly uninteresting. So if we look at fluctuations which induce logarithms, so the non-analytic pieces of the amplitude, which are the interesting pieces, come from collinear and soft fluctuations. So that was the original diagram that I drew here. So here's the soft fluctuations, and here are the collinear fluctuations. And one thing I did not derive for you is the fact, because of lack of time, is that actually the full action has another piece which factorizes from it, which is composed purely of soft fields. Okay? Okay. So if I look at the radiative corrections to this, then I find several interesting things. So first of all, I find so I can have this can either be a soft mode or a collinear mode of either type. And when I do these calculations, I run into some interesting problems. So in particular, if I calculate this in the effective theory, not only do I have ultraviolet divergences, but I also have a new type of divergence which is not regulated by dimensional regularization. So in fact, I have integrals that look like this. And I'm going to call this a rapidity divergence. Okay? So what is a rapidity divergence? A rapidity divergence exactly has to do with the fact that if I look at the rapidity space and I look at the modes that I've decomposed my fields into. So as I said, I haven't had time to show you how to decompose the modes into the soft modes, but it's done in a very similar way. And the soft modes have momentum scaling, which go like lambda, lambda, lambda. And they have virtuality lambda squared. Okay? So there's a soft mode that sits here. And there's collinear modes that sit here. So this is k squared is order lambda squared. And then I've got hard stuff out here. So those are large virtualities that I'm going to integrate out. Now, when you split up a field into different modes, you have to define what you mean by that mode. So just saying, the field has a collinear piece and a soft piece, you have to define what that means. So how do I delineate soft from, how do I distinguish soft from collinear, and how do I make sure I don't double count? Okay? So these modes differ in rapidity, but not in invariant mass. Okay? So this divergence is arising as a consequence of this ambiguity. I need to factorize the soft and the collinear modes, much as I factorize the hard from the soft modes. So we often think about, if you think about Wilsonian renormalization group, we usually think about integrating out shells. But the way I like to think about it is really that the cutoff is not a physical cutoff, of course. What it is a factorization scale, which is telling you, what do I define as hard and what do I define as soft? Okay. Now I have to define, what do I mean by soft and what do I mean by collinear? So there's a new factorization scale that has to be introduced. And when we come to von Hoeff singularities, I'll show you that the same thing has to be true in that case on the Fermi surface. So I have to introduce a new regulator above and beyond. So in QCD, I'm always going to work in dim reg because I have gauge symmetry, and working with a cutoff leads to headaches like gluon masses and so forth and so on because it explicitly breaks gauge invariance. And when we talk about the Fermi surface, we'll go back to cutoffs because the lack of symmetry makes that problem irrelevant. Okay, so I have to introduce a new factorization scale. And as I said, if I don't finish before 12:30, the factorization scale will be analogous to a scale which separates the von Hoeff patch from the non-von Hoeff patch on the Fermi surface. So the way I do, well, I introduce a regulator will be much different. So I'll introduce an eta regulator, and I'll introduce a scale nu, and nu will play the role of the factorization scale. Okay. And now I calculate with this factorization scale, and I generate lots of interesting things. So if I look at the soft integral, and I'll just sketch out what it starts to look like. So there's some function of epsilon and mu, and I'm going to put in a mass for the, so I'm going to put in a gluon mass here. So I'm actually not working QCD, but I can, I'll just Higgs it. This is just for the sake of illustration. So there's a 1 over eta pole. There's some poles that go like epsilon squared. And then we get some interesting things, that the ratio of the two factorization scales goes into the anomalous dimension. And then a log square, and then that's it. Okay? And then I have a collinear integral that looks much similar. The same function f with the same coefficient and a minus sign. And then some interesting logarithms of the two differing factorization scales. And this, again, will happen in the case of the von Hoeff patch. OK? So there are a couple of interesting things about the results. There are certain consistency conditions. The full theory has no dependence on this nu. The hard scattering doesn't care about rapidity separations. So it better be that between the collinear and the soft regions, all the rapidity divergences cancel. And that's just a statement that the factorization scale has to cancel between the different regions. The final physical result can't depend on the choice of factorization scale. And so there's two, and it's an n and n bar with both contribute this f with a minus 1 over eta. But then we see some interesting things about the anomalous dimension. In particular, the anomalous dimensions have these logarithms in it. And what's interesting is you could ask the question, well, this sort of violates a lot of the standard lore in effective field theories. The anomalous dimension should not have a logarithm in it. It should be a high energy quantity, not a long distance quantity. And this seems to clearly violate that. And you could ask the question, well, if I have a logarithm at one loop, how do I know I don't get two logarithms at two loops and three logarithms and so forth and so on? And the answer is because we know we can only get one logarithm because the new dependence has to cancel, and that's the only way it can cancel. And this will actually play a role again when we talk about the von Hoeff singularity. There'll be definite constraints from factorization scale independence. So there exists, so constraints exist. Okay? Okay. Yeah, that's right. So there are log squares also in the von Hoeff case as well. So So I need to say one other thing about this is now we have two types of renormalization group trajectories. We have a trajectory in mu and we have a trajectory in nu. So we call this the rapidity renormalization group. And it basically tells you how to resum all the logarithms systematically. Okay? So if I write the Sudikoff form factor operator, let me call it OS, the current, can be written as a product of a collinear piece, which is usually written as J and bar and S. Okay? So this is just a factorization of the fields, which I discussed before. And the collinear pieces have a natural scale nu, which is of order the high scale. And the soft pieces have a natural scale mu, which is of order the low scale. Okay? Mu is should be the low scale for both of them. So when we run, we have to run in both mu and nu. So we have to run one of these guys to one of these, they both can't be at their natural rapidity scale, right? So I have to run one of them using the nu RG. And I have to run both of them down from the high scale once I match at the high scale down to the low scale in mu. And in so doing, you can solve the set of renormalization group equations and get a nice closed form expression for what the Sudikoff form factor looks like with completely resummed logarithms. I should say, so this was developed actually, we developed this formalism in the context of transverse momentum distributions. Because this actually happens in any transverse momentum distribution. I think this was unappreciated. In particular, the existence of this extra nu scale was unappreciated in the literature. Okay, so that now I can talk about Fermi liquid theory. So I'm going to have to rely upon the fact that most of you are experts in Fermi liquid theory, so I can skip stuff so I don't have to actually finish at 12:30. I only have to finish at 12. Okay, so what does this have to do with Fermi liquid theory? I tried to point out along the way, in case I ran out of time.
I just want to say that you actually have to run at 11:30 to do
this. Oh, is that right? All right. I think there was a typo.
Somewhere.
Yeah. Okay, so what I'm going to do with Fermi liquid theory is I'm going to do the exact same thing I did. In this case, I'm going to split up the Fermi surface into some large label momentum, a K and an L. Okay, and so I'm going to have things that look like sum over pi, so this is pi, and then I have integrals over the continuous variable K, and I'm often just going to combine those into d4ks or dks. So K and L will both scale as lambda. But when I do, if I have a sum and an integral, this will scale as 1. Okay, so when I move away from the Fermi surface, that will cost me lambda. In principle, this wouldn't cost me anything. However, because I've decided to tessellate on scales of order lambda, K will give me order lambda unless accompanied by the sum over P. Okay, and this is what allows you to show that mean field theory is exact in the BCS channel without having to invoke any 1 over n arguments. Okay, so.
K is tangent to the focal surface?
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly tangent.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's some K squared dispersion that comes in, but you're going to ignore that.
Oh, so yeah, so as long as I'm away from any singularities, I'll take it to be linear. At leading order, that's all that's relevant. The quadratic pieces will be subleading. Okay, so so if we write down the action, Okay, so I'm going to expand around the Fermi surface. Then this is the standard power counting. And so without going through it, since I'm running out of time, the field scale as lambda to the minus 1/2. And even though the k scale is lambda, when I include the sum, this net thing scales as 1, and this guy scales as lambda. Okay, this guy scales as lambda. This guy scales as lambda. This is V Fermi, which is going to scale like 1. Okay? Okay, so if we go through the power counting, then the only relevant operators are at special kinematics because of the way the delta function scales. So just as we did in SCT, and now since I run out of time, I won't be able to go through it in this case. So there's the BCS channel, where we have the incoming guy, and we have forward scattering, where P1 is equal to P3. Okay, so this is okay. So, and the reason these guys are relevant and away from those kinematic regimes, it's not relevant, it's because of the way the delta function scales. Okay? So the delta function will scale, will give more power to 1 over lambda when we look at these particular channels. Okay? Now, if we look at the one loop corrections, so if we look at the one loop corrections, so we first introduce two operators. We introduce one operator, which looks like psi dagger psi p1 minus p1 p2 minus p2. And we'll call this BCS. And then we'll introduce forward scattering. There's also the cross channel as well. Okay. And now we can look at the renormalization. And the standard statement is if we look at forward scattering, then this guy, this integral is actually just 0 because the poles are on the same side. But what's more interesting is what happens if we try to iterate the BCS channel in a way. So if we try to iterate by taking in the BCS channel and adding a loop, we find that actually that's 0. And the reason is because this label sum is now killed by the delta function at this interaction vertex. And as soon as that label sum is killed, the measure no longer scales as 1 and gives you an extra power of lambda. Okay? And then you can actually just find that if you Taylor expand the integral in K, you just get 0. Okay. So because I've run out of time, I just want to say one other thing which is really cool. About the whole BCS business. So if we look at the BCS channel, at least let's look at it in the rotationally invariant case, what's interesting about it is that the coupling here can depend on the angles, because those are relevant directions. So if we write down when we do the one loop equation, we get an RG equation for the coupling. So the coupling RG equation looks something like this. Now if we allow for rotational invariance, this only depends on theta 1 minus theta 2. So that's what the RG equation looks like. And this is exactly the Altarelli-Parisi equation. So for the high energy physics, So the Altieri-Parisi equation is what tells you how the proton parton distribution function runs in mu. And if you look at the Altieri-Parisi equation, it looks like this. Some kernel. So what this is this is just an infinite dimensional anomalous dimension matrix labeled by the labels, the p's. Or in this case, the p's are the omegas, where you're sitting on the Fermi surface. And that's exactly what's happening in the case of the proton PDF. Just like we said that someone brought up in the beginning of the talk, that in Fermi liquid theory, I have large momenta scattering, and the momenta can change by large amounts. And that's exactly what's going on here. The same thing happens with the proton. A quark comes in, but it can change by a large amount by a splitting, right? And so I can solve this equation by expanding in spherical harmonics. And this equation I can expand by going to Millen-Barnes transform. And it diagonalizes both cases. We diagonalize the anomalous dimension and solve the RG equation. OK. So now I'm finally ready to talk about the von Hoeff singularity. So what is a von Hoeff singularity? A von Hoeff singularity is a spot on the Fermi surface in which the normal vanishes. So it's a flat direction where the first derivative is 0. And if I look, for instance, in the case of the isotropic Hubbard model, this is a perfect example. And I look at half filling. So this is pi minus pi. Then if I expand around these points, then I have that the energy functional looks something like, I put it over rho squared, because the first derivative vanishes. OK? So now, clearly, my power counting has to change because this is now 0, and I need to keep the next term. OK, so the whole power counting scheme is no longer as it was before. And now, when I write down the action, so I'm doing it in two dimensions. OK, and this is where things get really interesting. Because I can keep my energy small and make my momentum as large as I want. This is exactly analogous to what we were talking about in. So I can take. So here's. If I look at integrating out fluctuations around the von Hoeff singularity, I have two light-like directions. Right? So I can rewrite this as k plus k minus. And now the traditional RG equation is going to integrate out these fluctuations. And the problem is that I can go up to arbitrarily high k plus or k minus without costing any energy at all. Okay. So this is exactly analogous to the collinear mode. So now we have soft and collinear modes in exact analogy with what we had in the Sudikoff form factor. And in fact, if we start to, so now if I write down an interaction, so let's see how the, so now the momentum is no longer going to scale like lambda. So now k scales like lambda to the 1/2. And that's crucial, because it means now that if I write down an action for particles which live in the von Hoeff patch, then this is actually relevant independent of the choice of kinematics. So this is a relevant operator. And it doesn't matter if I'm at BCS or forward scattering or anything else. Okay, so now the question is, what does the low energy theory look like? So I've got a von Hove patch, and I have a non-von Hove patch, much like I have a collinear fields and soft fields. And I'm distinguishing them in some arbitrary way. And the final answer has to be independent of how I choose to distinguish the fields. So you would think, well, I'm going to, in fact, run into new divergences, which will not be cut off when I cut off the energy, right? Because it's arbitrary large k plus and k minus. And so I need to introduce a new factorization scale, a new regulator. So now I have two regulators, and I'm going to have two renormalization group equations, one in energy and one in rapidity. So I've already gone 10 minutes over. So let me just give you an upshot, a snapshot of what happens. So I'm not going to talk about the phenomenology, which I think would be very interesting. But I will tell you what the field theory results look like. So the way actually to do the integral, of course, is to go to, first of all, I should say, if I have the von Hove patch, then I'm not going to have rotational invariance anymore. So it's much better to parameterize the Fermi surface by an angle, theta, and do all the calculations in polar coordinates. And when you do that, you run into a problem. So if I... Yeah.
So, why do you need to pull for the
Well, you need the other piece of the Fermi surface because you're going to have to cut off the singularity at some point. And the final answer better be independent of that cutoff. And the only way to do that is to note that when you include the other patch, once the integral gets close to the Fermi surface, it too will have to be cut off. And the
contribution. No,
I'm just saying in the non von Hove patch.
Oh, that.
Yeah. Right? And that, so you'll actually have to, so there'll be another von Hove patch here, and so there'll be a cutoff here and a cutoff here, and you'll have to include all of them to get any sort of consistent result, which is in the. Yes, you're going to need both of them because when you go in this, when you integrate in this direction, you're going to hit a singularity as well, where the Fermi velocity vanishes, right? And you'll have to combine them both to get a piece which is independent. So I have to introduce a new regulator. So you have to introduce. You'll have to introduce a cutoff on the energy and a cutoff on the rapidity. I use the term rapidity loosely here. And what happens is that we have, if we look at particles in the von Hove patch, so if I look at, so I'll call VH von Hove particles. And these are BCS guys, or they can be von Hove guys. Thank you, Sean.
What is that? It's
Van Hove. That's von Hove.
Oh.
and what happens is that once you sum the two terms, so what happens is you get logarithms that go like. From the BCS guys. But from, so this is the BCS contribution. And from the von Hove contribution. And when you add them up, the rapidity divergence is canceled. But this rho, which told you about, which is of order the size of the Brillouin zone, which showed up here. Shows up in a logarithm, and those logarithms will have to be resummed, and those will be resummed by doing a rapidity renormalization group. So I haven't talked about what. These BCS guys are back-to-back guys.
They're particle-particle.
Yes, particle-particle channel, right? And these are Van Hove guys, which can be any kinematics that you want. And so whether or not there's an instability in what channel, I can't tell you right now because we haven't done that analysis. So the solution to the RG equations will be interesting. And I should say that these diagrams also generate non-local counter terms. So these diagrams actually generate a 1 over epsilon log of p squared. And so at first, this is a little bit troubling, because once I allow for non-local counterterms, I open Pandora's box and can ask, well, I could have an infinite number of logarithms. And if I have an infinite number of relevant operators, I have no predictive power. And this is, to me, an open question in non-relativistic field theories that no one knows how to prove, in that sense that is it true that every non-relativistic field theory can be described by an effective theory with a finite number of relevant operators? And I don't know the answer to that question. I think that's an open question that if someone could prove would be nice. So in this case, I get a counter term. So I'm going to generate a new operator. And the operator is going to look non-local. And it's going to look like this. And there's a delta function. And what this is telling you is that two electrons can meet at a point and then instantaneously be transported a light-like distance away as a consequence of the singularity in the Fermi surface. Now, you could ask the question, how do I know that when I go to higher loops that I won't generate? So this in momentum space gives me the logarithm. And how do I know that when I go to higher loops I won't generate new counterterms and then lose predictive power? And the answer is factorization. So just as I tried to point out in the case of the Sudikoff form factor, you can only have one log in the anomalous dimension. I'm almost done. You can only have one log in the anomalous dimension because the factorization scale has to cancel, and that's the only way it can happen. And the exact same thing happens here. So we know we don't generate any more logarithms as counterterms. It's only one. So we retain our predictive power. Now, the question is, how do I know that at the high scale I didn't have non-local interactions? But that seems unlikely because the non-local interactions come from integrating out short, long-distance fluctuations. So I don't have a proof that there aren't an arbitrary number. If I had a proof, I'd be very happy. But I don't have a proof that shows that there's only a finite number of relevant operators. However, it's completely self-consistent to start with just one non-local operator, and it will remain the RG and rapidity renormalization group flow will remain on the same manifold. The manifold, dimensionality of the manifold will not change as you change the running scale.